home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Good morning, everybody. I'm so excited to start my week off with you. You might say, well, yesterday was the start of the work week. Well, I didn't do a show yesterday because I had other stuff that was happening. So today is really my Monday. And what a great way to start the week here on the show, because today we have author Seamus Byrne, who's going to be on the show in just a couple of moments, talking about his award-winning album called Breakout from Sugar Island. He's going to talk to us about that and so much more. But of course, before we bring our featured guest on today, I want to give you a roadmap of where we're going for the week so you can set your clocks accordingly and tune in as you will. I also want to remind everybody, the show is available on iTunes as a podcast. So if you'd like to get that for free, of course, you can get the most recent 300 episodes of the show. And I know you probably are sad that you can't get all 1,000 shows that we've done over the last 3 years or so, 4 years, but you have other things to do in your life. But you can get the most recent 300, and that's great, including today's episode, which will be on after the show is completed. Tomorrow on Rated G Radio, we've got psychic Rebecca Fisk. She's been named one of America's top 50 psychics. She'll be back on, and when she calls, it's always one of the most popular shows of the month. We always get hundreds of calls, literally, for her to ask a question. So my little secret for you is, if you'd like to ask Rebecca a question tomorrow, the phone lines do open at 7:45 a.m. Pacific time, and you can call in, and we'll sneak you in ahead of everybody else who calls, just because it's it's that type of show. On Thursday's Rated LGBT Radio, we've got two awesome guests with my co-host Rob Watson. We've got Josh Ballinger with a new web series called Dumb Luck. It's a political comedy based in Iowa. I think it's Iowa. And then we also have Mr. Leon Acord with Old Dogs, New Tricks. They have done a mini movie, and I actually get to have a small part in that. But Leon's going to be coming on to talk about the premiere of the movie, which is taking place this Saturday. And then on the Friday night dance party, we're starting the party an hour early. We're going to do your requests starting at 6, and then an hour number 2, live from Sydney, Australia. We have musician, Christian artist Bruce Wayne Birch calling into the show. And I want to say, I know which album we're playing, but he sent me like 30 tracks. So I know that we've got a bunch of music from different things that he's been promoting. So we'll be playing a variety of his music on the Friday night dance party. He'll be an hour 2, and that actually starts at 7 on Friday night. That's the lineup for the week, everybody. Now today, you know, I've got his profile in front of me, and I never want to read somebody's profile because I'd much rather have them tell us about it, because I think that's much more interesting. I will tell you, though, Seamus Byrne is a fine gentleman who I've met, probably last year sometime, maybe even longer, at the Southern California Writers Association. We're going to talk about that as well. And he is he's somebody who I just immediately knew I would love to have on the show at some point when schedules and the planets aligned. And today's finally going to be the day. And so without further ado, because, again, I could just read his profile, but we're going to be talking to him and we're going to let him do that for us. Seamus, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm great, and thank you for having me. It's a thrill to be here, and I hope the planets are aligned.
I do, too. I always hope the planets are aligned. But, you know, we always have a good time here on the show. I want to always give shout-outs to the people who always connect the guests in here to the show, because I think it's important that they get a little bit of recognition as well, because this is how we get great guests. Other people have been on the show, and they say, you need to be on, and, you know, we get the dots connected. So, again, for all the fine folks at the Southern California Writers Association, to Jeff and Jill, Jeff Michaels, who's been on the show as an author and as a guest before, they're also technically my neighbors. They're in Arizona listening this morning. But a big shout out to them for making sure that we got introduced in quick fashion. You were one of the first people I think I got a chance to meet at SCWA. So that was kind of fun. So Seamus, as we start today, because this is, even though I've talked to you, we haven't really, chit chatted about who you are and, your background and all of this. So can you kind of tell us about, who you are and how you grew up and, how you came to be this great author today?
Well, thank you very much. I grew up in Ireland, as I think you knew. spent my early years there. I grew up in a small little town, and it was a town that had a lot of influence on me as a writer, so I wanted to mention that. Very picturesque place, beautiful trees, rivers, mountains, green. But, of course, the downside of green is rain. It was also a historic town. We had an old English mansion called the Big House, which is actually in my novel. House of built in the 17th century. I grew up there, went to school there, to a two-room schoolhouse. And Ireland is a very Catholic country, so many young men went into the priesthood, and so did I. And in high school, they came around to recruit us, and I decided to go with a group in the United States. Now, that was a big, big step to take, because it was like stepping into the unknown. What I knew of the United States was Hollywood. And obviously, that was not a very accurate portrayal of what America was like. But I went, and not at all. But yet, I think a lot of Europeans have that idea, although intellectually, right, they know it's different, but in their head, they kind of associated with that. So I ended up in New Hampshire, in New England. And I remember that I came to the States on one of the last ocean liners called the Britannic. That was 1958. And I think the next year they issued in jet travel. So I ended up in this place in New Hampshire, and it was called the Shattuck Inn. It was a turn-of-the-century hotel where the elites in Boston used as a getaway place. That was before my religious order, the Congregation of the Sacred Hearts, bought it. I was amazed to find out when I got there, although at this time I didn't know the significance of it. There was rumors that an author had died in the third floor of this old mansion, this old inn. Well, it turns out that the author was, she wrote My Antonio, and Death Comes to the Archbishop. So I was thrilled to hear that, although I didn't know exactly who it was at the time. So one thing led to another. I got ordained, went back to Ireland for ordination, and came back and was assigned to high school in California. I taught there for 5 years, and during that time I got an MA, met my future wife, decided probably that I wanted to do something else. I always wanted a family. So I left the priesthood and got a job teaching in high school. And that was in Fountain Valley in Huntington Beach. I spent 25 years there. And during that time, I taught English. I taught Latin. But I also was the president of the teachers union, which was really an interesting job. And sometimes could be bring you into a lot of conflict with others. But it was interesting. So after I got my MA, and I decided I wanted to do something else, so I had a shot at administration, and that's what I did for the last 9 or 10 years of my life before I retired. But in the long run, I think I look back and think, well, that was an interesting experience, and I don't think I would change it.
Okay, I want to backtrack here. So you grew up in Ireland, and you went. So I'm going to get how much we're going to talk about the book in a second. But so now I'm kind of like crossing over into some of the elements of the book. Were any of the towns or areas that you wrote about, you know, like the Big House? How true to life is that from a scenic perspective? Would the reader get when they're reading your book? Because you write very, very visually. So every page and everything that you're writing, Seamus, I totally picture exactly what's going on in vivid, broad detail.
Well, actually, the depiction of the Big House is very, very accurate. On my website, I have a picture of that. It was built in the 17th century. And I can tell you a little bit about the background of that place. When people think of the Big House in the States, I think they think of two things. Either it's a jail, or right, they think of Downton Abbey.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The TV show. But the Big House in Ireland usually was a very different place. it was the center of it was the economic center and the cultural center of the society. It was the powerhouse in the society. In Downton Abbey, they portray this really congenial relationship between the landlord and the gentry and the help. But in actual fact, that's not the way it was at all. I think in one of the episodes of Downton Abbey, they have the chauffeur marry one of the ladies of the house. Well, that would never have happened. In the big house in my hometown of Strokestown, there was strict discrimination. There was separation. And the lady, to give you an idea of what, to the degree that was taken, the lady of the house would not walk into the kitchen. They had a big balcony overlooking the kitchen, and she would drop down a note to the chef and to the cooks and to the way, because she didn't want to talk to them. So that was one thing, real separation.
Wow.
They also had built a warren of secret passages or hidden passages and stairways so that the help would never meet the gentry. And if they did meet him, what they were required to do was to dive into one of these secret or hidden passages or stairways so they wouldn't meet him. I was home
how
in Ireland last summer. Go ahead.
I said, how interesting is that? That they had. Can you imagine being the architect for something like that? Going, okay, we've got 10,000 square feet of living space, and we need 100 secret passages or something like that.
Well, yeah, it absolutely was crazy. But what it really emphasized was the real discrimination in the society into which mm-hmm. my character Redfern was born. But I was home in Ireland 2 years ago, and my brother told me something that our mom had told him. And you know, sometimes in families, everybody has a different take on what went on in the family. Well, he told me that our mother told him that the help in that big house, they were required to whistle as they brought the food to the table. Now, you might ask, why would you have to whistle? Well, the reason they did that is if you're whistling, you cannot taste the food. You cannot sample the soup. So really incredible. But that happened. So that was inside on the house. So real discrimination. People knew their place, and in the novel I mentioned this, where they escape into these passages, and it was a place to eavesdrop as well. But outside the big house, the landlord was ruled supreme, and in my hometown of Strokestown, he had about 30,000 acres. Now he was if you picture that as a pyramid, he was the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
So he would. There was a hierarchy of people underneath him. He would rent out the land, let's say, to middlemen underneath him. They may get 200 or 300 acres, and they in turn would rent out the land to small farmers, and they rented it out to landless laborers. So there was a real hierarchy, but the people at the bottom of the pyramid really didn't have anything. They had to scrounge around to get a piece of land or tillage, as they called it, to plant for potatoes, because the Irish pretty much survived on potatoes during that period of time.
Yeah.
So it was a tough life. And as I said, Redfern was born into that, my character.
And I will tell you, the first part of the book is really hard for me to get through. And I will tell you, because their struggle in everything they do just seems so overwhelming. And it's like, can't these guys catch a break? I think that was one of the things that I could totally see happening as a real world scenario. So I wasn't really reading this as a, fictional novel. I was reading this as, maybe this is like a retelling of exactly what was going on back, during that time period, because it just seemed so, it seemed so realistic, but also so unfair for a lot of the folks that were, displaced from their homes, and they just couldn't catch any type of a break. But I'm going to jump back to you a little bit later. So why did you think that this was going to be the book that you wanted to write? Because you had this great professional career, you retired, and you said, I think I'm going to sit down and be a writer now. How did all of that come about?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I was fascinated by books and writing. In that two-room schoolhouse, we had a small little library. The library consisted of a bookcase with glass doors, and it was supplied by the county. But as far as I could tell, nobody ever used it. But I decided I'd take a shot, and I went up and I got a book. And I didn't realize that I could even do that. It was this big, thick book. And it was about a rescue in Antarctica. And I was thrilled. I thought, wow, I can be entertained and have fun and involve my imagination without having to go to a movie or whatever. So I decided that I wanted to read more. But as I said, I wanted to write too, but I didn't think I had the ability to do it. So as time went on, and I got to the States, I thought about something I had read in history. And as you may or may not know, Ireland was ruled by the British. And in 1641, there was a huge rebellion. And Cromwell, the leader of the English, came to subdue the Irish. And it was a pretty brutal put-down. And that was the time when these big houses were built, the big house. They make a long story short, he invaded the country. They destroyed the crops, burned the corn. They just made it a wasteland. And he attacked towns and cities to put the rebellion down. And he, with the promise that if they laid down their arms, that he would, if they surrendered, they would be okay. But he slaughtered everybody. Mm. And at the end of that period of time, what he did was that he rounded up the survivors. The soldiers themselves, the Irish soldiers, had the opportunity to join the armies of France or Spain, some country that was not at war with England. But that left thousands and thousands of women and dependents and children wandering the highways. So what he did was he rounded them up. And I put them in pens outside towns. They rounded them up with bullwhips, put them in pens outside towns, and shipped them off to the sugar colony of Barbados. The one thing that Ireland and Barbados had in common is they were both ruled by England. So he shipped them there as white slaves. I remember that event, and I was trying to think, well, there was one little mention of it in my history book, that the Irish had been shipped as slaves to Barbados. But I never heard anything more about it, and I just wondered about what became of them. So they were sent there, and the reason you had the situation then in Ireland for the several centuries was Cromwell actually took all the land, so he left people destitute. They had no means of support, and they were totally depending on the landlord and the jobs he would give them. So getting back to that's how I started writing the novel. I thought that's a very interesting premise, and I decided I would have a shot at it. But in terms of my writing history, I had started a novel. My wife published a novel back in the early 80s, and she and a friend did that. I kind of helped her on the periphery, but not much. So later on, we decided we'd write a novel ourselves. And that didn't get anywhere, but we discovered, later on that the agent had forgot to send the last two chapters to the producer.
You know, that only kind of makes it a little bit of a difference.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But sometimes once that happens, they don't want to revisit it.
Right.
So that went nowhere. But I read a book by Walter Mosley, and it was This Year You Will Write Your Novel. And I was impressed by the fact that he said, This Year You Will Write Your Novel. He didn't say, This Year You Will Publish Your Novel, which is a huge distinction. And that got me kind of interested, and he gave a kind of a blueprint as to how to write a novel. And part of his idea was you write every single day. And I thought that would be a real, real chore, but I discovered it that indeed that was the way to do it, for me at least, because you got a lot of practice. The only other thing I had done before that in terms of writing was I edited school newsletters. I wrote for school newsletters, but I also wrote two or three articles for the LA Times, opinion pieces. And I remember I had written two, and one was about after being 20 years in the classroom, and it was a kind of a memoir type of thing. I wrote another one after that when I was the head of the teachers' union. And then I wrote a third. Now, of course, this is in the days when there were no cell phones, and we went on vacation. I sent that off and never heard back, but when I came back, the editor told me, oh, we were looking for you. Where we were going to publish the article, but we couldn't find you, and that never amounted to anything. So later on, though, when I was I went into administration in high school, I decided I would write an article about the job I did. And what I did was I was a dean of students. I was in charge of supervision in the school. And the school was about 3,500 kids. So there was a lot of action every day. So I wrote the article and I sent it to the same editor. Now, this is a real lesson too in being authentic. Write what you know and write it honestly. And he wrote back to me, or called me back, and he said, Seamus, write the article you're supposed to write. This is not you. I mean, I had written for him before. And I thought, yeah, he's figured it out. You know, I'm hedging my bets here a little bit, which I was. But I was in a different position there. I was in management. So I decided, well, okay, I will write the article the way it should be written. And I did. But I presented it to the boss, and they said, nah. No, so that never came to pass. So then, as I said, once I got out of high school and once I retired, then I had a lot of time on my hands. And that old idea came back about the Irish slaves being sent to Barbados. And I thought, you know, that sounds like an interesting topic. So I did some research, and I found out, in other words, there was not a lot being written about this, and I often wondered about that. How come this seems to be such a secret? And I found a book written by an Irish journalist called Sean O'Callaghan, and he was an Irish Times writer, and he went to Barbados, and he researched this, and he pretty much discovered that the sugar colony of Barbados was really a concentration camp. The sugar commodity was like oil, as oil was later on. It was called white gold. But to produce this, to make it profitable, they had to run it the same way as later on in the States. The cotton industry is one. They use slaves. So he discovered all of that, and it looked like a horrific place. But it gave me the idea this could be a cool spot to write a novel about.
Yeah.
So I had my protagonist, Michael Redfern, kidnapped in Ireland. He's in this oppressive society. He's kidnapped. He's shipped to Barbados, and he is branded and has to work in the cane fields morning to dusk. And pretty horrific place. And then the way I set it up was that, well, he has got two choices here. Either he escapes or he dies, because very few of those people came back. Cromwell actually shipped 60,000 Irish men and women and children to Barbados. But anyway, that's where I got the idea for that novel, was that experience in writing that.
I'm kind of in shock, because, you know, you wouldn't – I mean, I love the story about the – getting here, but then you tell me that, you know, we had 60,000 people from Ireland that were shipped there to do that. But that whole, I mean, for any culture that was, you know, impacted this way, it's absolutely horrible, but it's a fascinating story. Hey, Seamus, I got a question for you. You know, you talked several times about things that, you know, this book didn't happen because the last two chapters weren't sent, or I couldn't get this article published because it, you know, my boss wouldn't sign off on it. You had a lot of things that you put a lot of time and energy on. How do you think your life would have unraveled, if you, you know, if you could look back in a crystal ball and say, okay, if that book would have been published, here's where I'd have been today. How do you look at the time of what might be perceived as setbacks, and how that shaped, you know, how you've become a writer or the person that you are today?
Well, I think setbacks in writing is par for the course. That's the way that most writers experience rejection. And rejection is part of, you know, learning the craft and learning the traits. Sometimes you're rejected because what you're doing is not good enough. It simply doesn't meet a standard. But you do learn from that, and you learn to push on. I don't know if my life would have been changed that radically, because I discovered, you know, in those early days when my wife wrote that novel, you couldn't make a living at it unless you really wrote a great novel, unless you had a real big hit. It was very hard to make a living. And so I learned that you probably would have to have a second job. And and I know a lot of writers do, but at the same time, a lot of writers, you know, they go for it and they try to make it, and it's a real tough struggle. So in that sense, I think it was a good insight that it told me that writing is hard, that you need to keep at it. And because of that, when I was retired, I decided that I needed to learn to write, to learn about the craft of writing. And so I went to a lot of conferences, read how-to books. And one of my favorite conferences is the Southern California Writers Conference. And the good thing about that is you meet people like yourself, and you meet people who are struggling and trying to get something published. But as I said, some of the most valuable experiences in writing conferences are that you get to talk to other writers. You can share your experiences with them, and they share their experiences with you. And so it gives you an insight into the whole business of what's going on. I'm just trying to think what was the second part of your question?
Well, I like where you're going with this. It's just the, you know, where you're networking and learning about the craft itself. And isn't that so interesting that, you know, as a writer, and I'm, because we're talking about books today, so I'm going to use that as the analogy, but for anybody who's in a creative field or not, maybe you're an accountant, but when you network and are able to go and commiserate and, you know, share your stories with other people, a lot of times I think, you know, you might think that maybe I'm alone out here and nobody's going through this. And then you meet people Southern California Writers Conference or the Association monthly meetings, and you go like, oh, there's a lot of really cool folks out here, and they're going through the exact same thing I'm going through. I mean, did you have aha moments like that where, you know, you walked out and felt a little bit more validated about what you wanted to do?
Oh, absolutely. You meet people at conferences, and they're sharing what they're writing, and especially if you're selling a book, it's really simple. I was at a conference in San Diego last year and sat at the table with maybe 10 or 11 people, and they asked you what you're doing. And I told them I'd written a book and what the book was like. And I think I sold three novels right at the table. So it gives you opportunities to do that as well. But you get an idea of the struggle that most people are going through. And for the majority of people that go to conferences, the payoff is actually the conference itself. You learn about the craft. You learn what to do and what not to do. But you have a sense of there's a kind of a camaraderie out there, and you make friends. And I think that helps you as a writer. I always leave a conference. I usually learn something. And the biggest thing you come away with is this, you know, I got to start writing again. And that in itself is a huge benefit, because I can write every day, getting back to what Arthur Moseley said, while I'm doing the rough draft. But after the rough draft is done and I'm doing the edits, then it doesn't happen every day. Yeah. But as I said, during the rough draft, I do write every day. And And you meet other writers who are involved in the same kind of struggle. And some of them write every day, some of them do not. But it's a, I benefited a lot from those conferences and also from how-to books. And a how-to book that I would plug is Matt Palomari's, you know, fantastic writing. It's a how-to book, and I have gotten a lot out of it. It's but the only book that is called Fantastic Fiction. It's but the only book that I know of sounds like it's a page turner, and you don't expect that with how-to books, but that one is.
Well, Matt's a friend of the show, and I enjoy his writing a great deal. And so, if you know anybody who's out there who wants more information about Matt, just let me know, and I'll connect the dots for you too. This is going to be a great time to. We're at the halfway point. I can't believe it. The hour's just flying by. We're at the halfway point. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Hear from our friends at It Matters Radio and Rainbow Brew. You've got 2.5 minutes if you need to run to the restroom or fill up your cup of coffee. We'll be back with more of Seamus Byrne and his novel Breakout from Sugar Island right after this.
Welcome to our discussion of It Matters Radio. Our guest today is Angus McWilliams.
Hey, laddie, let's get on with this thing. I'm on my way to a birthday party for Nessie.
You're throwing a birthday party for the Loch Ness Monster?
First of all, it's not a monster. And second of all, I'm talking about niece Nessie. She's a wee bit of a lovely lass.
I see. Well, okay. Angus, can you give us your thoughts on It Matters Radio?
I wonder how people. They had me on a while back to talk about my book.
Your what?
My book. I wrote a book about the adventures in Scotland.
Oh, I see. A book.
That's what I just said. What are you, a duff man?
It Matters Radio focuses on discovering new talent and bringing important indie artists on the air. Monica, Kenneth, and Carrie offer up meaningful conversation on new music, books, and fun topics. It's unlike any other radio program known to man and woman alike.
You can say that again.
Known to man and woman alike.
Just because I said you can say it again doesn't mean you have to say it again.
I'm just doing my best to show everyone that It Matters Radio basically brings variety, fun, and entertainment with a sincere desire to discover new topics and talent.
Why didn't you just say that?
I just did.
Hey, laddie, remind me when I can listen.
It Matters Radio is on every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific.
You Americans with your different time zones. We only have one time zone in Scotland.
And that would be...
That would be the time to down a pint or two of ale.
It Matters Radio, for the best in conversation, music, books, and entertainment. Join us Thursday evenings at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. Discover the depth, diversity, meaningfulness, caring, guest-focused, friendly, enjoyable atmosphere of It Matters Radio with Ken, Monica, and Carrie.
That's a mouthful if I ever heard one.
Yes, and I'm going to go brush my teeth now. It Matters Radio.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the Queen Bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
So I always love our friends at Rainbow Brew. They're a coffee company based out of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And when they approached me probably about a year ago to come on the program as a sponsor, they I said, how are you going to convince me that, you know, you can make great coffee out of the frozen tundra? And so they sent me a little bit, and it is quite tasty. They've got several different blends, you know, like a lot of the, you know, boutique coffee companies today. But if you go to rainbowbrew.com, place an order, tell them you heard them here on Rated G Radio, and they will actually do a happy dance as they grind your beans before they send the package up. If you like their page on Facebook, you can also oftentimes find dollar off coupons, online coupons, and other special offers that they will provide to you. So check them out. Also, as you are sitting here watching the show on your computer, we've got a ton of advertisers that have you know, their ads going through here. So if you see something you like or have questions, you know, contact them directly or let me know, because I know most of these folks directly and would be happy to, you know, give you a recommendation or tell you what I know. We are joined today by author Seamus Byrne. His novel is called Breakout from Sugar Island. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about, you know, going to writers' conferences and networking with other authors and writing every day. And this brings up a great topic here, Seamus, of what is your writing process? And, you know, when you sit down to do something like this, you know, what's your schedule like? How do you decide, you know, today is a Tuesday and here's what I'm going to do? What do you do on a daily basis?
Well, when I refer back to when I write a rough draft, I pretty much write every day. And I try to write in the morning maybe for about 2 hours. My output normally in that 2 hours might be 3 pages, double-spaced pages. Sometimes it's more. Now, there are some writers that can write 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 words a day. I'm not one of them. But I can crank out if I'm really going 5 pages a day. But for me, you asked about the writing process or my – it's a process of discovery. And unlike many writers, I don't start with a plot or a plan, as many writers do. Ben Cain does that. Ken Follett, who is a historical writer, does that. Follett turns in a summary or a plot synopsis of 60 pages. That's not the way I write. I heard someplace recently a person who won a big award in the States, and he likened the process of writing to improvisational jazz. And I thought, yeah, that's kind of what it is. At least it is for me. And that idea for me was reinforced by a quote from E.L. Doctorow. He's an American novelist who wrote Ragtime, and I believe they made a movie out of that. And Doctorow said that for him, writing was like driving a car at night on a dark road. You see as far as the lights allow you to, and you can continue the whole journey like that. Well, that's exactly what it is for me, but my analogy is a little bit darker than that. I feel like I'm down in a coal mine, and I'm picking away every day.
Oh, my gosh, that's really dark.
So I'm picking away every day, and the choice, do I proceed to follow that vein of coal or I do that? So those are decisions you make as you go along. But when you finish and you walk back out, you say, oh, yeah, so I came that far today. So to begin with, I have an outline in my head now. It's not a very detailed outline. For example, with Breakout from Sugar Island, the outline I had was Michael Redfern is born into this unjust, oppressive society. He is restless, aggrieved, and ticked off at the world. His human rights and his social rights are being denied, and he wants to break out. And then he gets in trouble with the local landlord, and one thing leads to another. He's kidnapped or abducted and shipped off to the sugar colony of Barbados and becomes a slave. Now, that's all I had. Now, that's not a novel. You've got to put meat on the bones of that. And so I start in every day, you know, looking at the blank page, reading what I read, what I wrote the day before, and try to put meat on those bones. But now, for me, I cannot sneak into the novel. I cannot say, well, I'm going to summarize now what the next chapter is going to be. It doesn't work like that for me. I have to, it's like if you go into a car and you got to drive the car, you cannot drive the car unless you turn the engine on. And to me, I have to literally start writing. And as I write, then it begins to flow. Now, that doesn't mean you don't struggle and that's the way it's going to be in the final edit, but you want to get the rough draft done first. Now, as you can probably figure out, such an approach wouldn't lend itself to starting out with full, well-developed characters with all their foibles and their weaknesses and their goals and motivations are laid out. Not that's not true. That couldn't be like that for me. Now, some writers, and you've probably heard of this, before they write, along with having an outline or a plot, they also will conduct interviews with characters, with their fictitious characters. They will assign them personality types. They will write descriptions, which is great. But to me, that sounds more like engineering, and I cannot do that. So I know my characters by following them around, literally. I follow them around. I judge who they are, but the way you judge in real life, how do you get to know people? You don't know people the first time you meet them, or the second or the third. You gradually know people, and it's the same for characters, how they respond to crises, how they carry the burdens of the world on their shoulders, what kind of relationships they have with people. So all of that gradually, for me, forms the character. And because of that, the names I assign characters in the beginning are not necessarily the names I usually keep, because I don't know them well enough. I guess I could sum it up by saying, for me, the development process, especially with characters or with a novel, is like the old Polaroid cameras, if you remember those.
Oh,
yeah. The Polaroid, you took a photograph, and you waited for a while, and it whirred and buzzed, and then it shot out a little black type card, pitch black. And as you waited a little while longer, the black turned into swatches of gray, smoky gray, and then that morphed into greens and reds and yellows, and finally the image formed. But kind of that's the way I think my characters develop. After all that process is done, that's how I get to the characters.
And I love that explanation. I resonate with that because that's kind of my thought process too. You know, I've talked to a lot of authors who will say, you know, before I sit down, I've storyboarded the whole thing, or I've written complete, you know, binders full of, you know, character descriptions and what happened when they were, you know, a year old and, you know, on their 16th birthday, what happened to them. And of course, none of that's ever referenced in the book. And I keep thinking to myself, boy, you spend a lot of time. And if that works for them, great. So I'm not criticizing, but my logic goes, you spend so much time writing all of this other stuff that you could have just been writing the book. And then,
well, you know, and absolutely, E.L. Doctorow, that I quoted before about the dark driving on the road, dark at night, he will claim that he writes the same way as I do, or I write the same way as he do. He does, but he claims that interviewing, researching, summarizing, writing plots, that's not writing. Writing is writing. So he said you have to sit down and write. Now, for the people that works for them, Elizabeth George is the same way. She writes endless, you know, summaries and plot character descriptions. But as I said, it works for them. I think the upside of that approach, though, is that you kind of have a tighter rein on your rough draft.
Sure.
If you're writing by the seat of your pants, the way I have settled for this, so I accept it, that the rough draft in the end is my big outline. And so now I can refine that in editing. And
so how much editing did you do on this at that point then? Because it would seem like if you're going to follow that path and using that logic, that you might have some substantial, you know, rewrites that happen once you finish that draft.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I edited as much as I could. My wife helps me in editing. But here's the thing about editing. After a while, you don't see your own mistakes.
Right.
You just don't see them. The mind supplies them. My wife wouldn't see them either. So you do. That would be my advice to new authors. You need somebody else to edit your stuff, to read your stuff at least, because you won't pick it out. I remember, just as an aside, my wife and I were doing, I think it was at the time we had foreign students, we handled foreign student exchange, and we sent letters out to churches and different groups looking for host families. And about 10 years later, I was going through an old file, and I saw one of these letters we'd sent out. I've got an MA in English, she's got a BA in English.
See, you should know what you're doing.
The word in the first line was misspelled.
Oh, my gosh.
A gross spelling error. And I just use that as you just don't see it after a while. And that's back to the book again. That's why, in the end, after I have done as much editing as I can, I have beta readers. I mean, the beta readers are my friends, actually. And you'd be amazed. Somebody with a fresh pair of eyes would point something out, an inconsistency in a plot or a plot that's dropped or isn't being developed, you know, are just missing words. They will catch that up. So finally, I turned it over to Matt Palomari. And God bless Matt. He spent a long time at it. And he went through it and made a lot of recommendations, cut a lot of stuff out. And most writers have to do that. Otherwise, it becomes a UBF. So there is a lot of, they say that writing takes place in the editing. That's where the story is formed.
Well, you know, because I think it, as writers, you know, you think as you're writing that draft, every word and every comma and every exclamation point is absolutely divinely inspired. And boy, there can't be an extra word in here whatsoever. And then you give it to somebody like Matt and he's like, okay, we're cutting out 30%. You know, let's start bleeding. And, you know, off your book goes. And then, you know, you have your cohesive story.
That comment ties in with what the advice you get. Ray Bradbury has said many things, obviously, but he says, write hot, edit cool. In other words, in your first draft, you shouldn't spend a lot of time editing. Just get it down on paper. Because if you start editing, if you start overthinking it, then you'll spend a lot of time going back, editing and correcting, and you'll never get it done. So there's an old saying out there, don't let perfection be the enemy of done. And that's what times with a lot of new writers, they never get off the dime. They spend so much time polishing the first chapter or the first page that they never get it done. And that's when Mosley talks about this year you write your novel. The objective there is get the thing finished, because until you get it finished, nothing else can happen.
Right.
So you've got to get it done. And so that's why they say don't spend a lot of time editing in the beginning. Now, in terms of editing, I think I fall someplace in the middle. I will edit a little bit what I've done that day, but not a lot of heavy stuff. I will edit the stuff that looks obvious because I don't want to forget it. If it's suddenly I read my two or three pages, and say, oh, yeah, I can say this better, or I can tighten the language here, I will do that, but I won't get into a heavy edit. And another reason for not editing up front is this, that you could be editing a chapter for a week and making changes and changing the beginning and fixing it and turning it around. And then in the long run, you drop that chapter. It's not even in the book.
Right.
That has happened to me. That doesn't bother me that bad, because if you're writing and editing, well, then you're learning to write. So I'm okay with that. But again, as Bradbury says, write hot, edit cool. And another piece of advice Bradbury had was, and this I think is good advice for new writers, and I wish I had known about this in the beginning, but it was that write short before you write long. And by that he meant write short stories before you tackle a novel. Now, there's a lot of wisdom in that when you think of it.
Yeah.
Because a short story is a microcosm of a novel. And you have character development, you have plot and all of that. The problem is you get it done in 20 pages and you can go back and take a look at it. With a novel, you may have 120 pages, or I mean, you may have 300 or 400 pages. So it's a much wieldier document. So I thought that's good advice to new writers.
Well, I think that is good advice. And it's you know, you learn to crawl before you walk and walk before you run. And,
right.
You know, run before you drive a car and all of that. So we've got, I don't know, about 5-6 minutes left, Seamus. I've got so much more I want to ask you about, but I'm going to ask you about the business outside of, you know, the writing part of this. So, you know, you get the book done and you've written the, you know, next great novel that the world just has to read. How did you decide how you were going to approach publishers? You know, did you want to do it yourself? What was your story with that part of the process?
Well, I think my story is probably fairly typical of most writers. You know, I went to conferences and I interviewed with agents and I got some good feedback at times. They wanted 50 pages, then they wanted the whole thing, but nothing ever happened. Sometimes they don't write back to you at all. So I went back and forth and I went down that path. I actually won quite a few awards in San Diego for the stuff I had turned in, so that was encouraging. But it never quite got there. And you never know the reason for that. Mine is a historical novel. So you have to be careful, too, that you're dealing with agents who are interested in historical novels. You're not dealing with somebody who, an agent who, you know, buys mysteries or buys memoir. It may not be the right fit. So you have to try and find the right fit. And sometimes that's hard. And it's also the same with looking for editors. you can get contradictory advice from editors. So what do you do? And you have to go with a gut feeling. But so anyway, I started to investigate small publishers. And I discovered a publisher in San Diego or in Arizona called Fireship Press. And they publish historical novels. And they
Perfect.
Publish a lot of, yeah, right, perfect, a lot of seafaring novels. And I sent it off to them, and in about a week or two, I got a letter back that they wanted to give me, or they, first of all, they wanted the first three chapters. And then he said, and also send the last chapter. And I thought that was kind of funny for two reasons. It was, they wanted to find out, has this guy the book finished?
Or right.
Is he submitting a partial? Or they wanted to figure out, how does this book end? What's the ending like? Because that's important. So they bought the novel, and then they had a reversal of fortune somehow. They went through reconfiguration, and that always breeds problems. And so it took longer to get it published than I anticipated. But they got back on track again, and it came out last September. But it's a long struggle. I mean, and again, another thing I think you realize is that when you see the book in book format, and I would advise new writers, try to get a copy of the book before it's finished, because it's amazing. When you see the actual book in a book format, all kinds of things jump out at you that you mm-hmm. never recognize in, let's say, in a manuscript form. So to overcome that, now what I'm doing is I'm loading the rough drafts or my manuscripts into Kindle Fire, and that comes out more or less in book form. And it's amazing the stuff I will see in those smaller pages in book form that you don't recognize in the larger form. Also, another thing I do now is I write in single script or in single space, and I edit in single space, which seems counterintuitive, but what I discovered is you have a much better sense of what's on the page if it's in single space. You can see more, and mm-hmm. you can see how the parts are interconnected. Plus, you kind of psych yourself out. If you have half a page written in a single space, you say, well, I can't stop now at half a page. At least I got to finish the page, which is two pages of double type.
Double space. There you go.
Double space. Yeah.
So okay,
that was my experience with getting it published, and it's a long process, and you got to be patient. It doesn't happen overnight.
So once it's published, though, Seamus, what do you do, or you know, do you have any type of a marketing plan or a business plan on now? I've got a case of books in the garage, and I got to move them. You know, so where do you go after you know you've gone through all of this and the book's ready to be out there and be sold on the market?
Well, what I've done since it was published, I've spoken at several in libraries and sometimes to book clubs, and I did Lit Up in Tustin, which
Maddie's
you read Maddie's group, and SCWA with Larry, he will plug the book, he will talk about it, and I think I told you about SCWA on last Saturday.
Which is the great segue because we have to hear the story.
Right. So Larry Porcelli, he is honoring certain writers that whose books he liked, he thought they were good, and he interviews you a little bit as he walks around the table. And we had a speaker there called Robert Klein. Well, I didn't know that much about Klein, but he's a Hollywood director, producer, and he's written and produced and directed, but he has worked with Oliver Stone. He's done a lot of documentaries. So he has a long filmography, and he was given the presentation. At the end of the presentation, they had set up that the author, the writers, could make a pitch from the floor. You stood up in the group, and he said, you got one sentence, less than a minute, to make a pitch to him. And so a lot of people pitched, and some of them read from scripts, and he said, no, that's not a good idea. Don't use cue cards or don't use index cards. Don't use writing. Just say your pitch. So I get up, and it was just one long sentence about my guy being shipped as a slave to Barbados, blah, blah, blah. And then he had to make a choice, escape or die. And so I finished and I'm standing there and he looks at me. There's dead silence. And he said, "Have your people called my people?" And I thought, wow, I wonder what that means. Well, I knew what it meant, but I wasn't exactly sure. And then there were a few follow-up questions. And in the end, Larry came to my table and said, Robert wants a copy of your book. He'd like to read it. So now I have my book with a top Hollywood director. I mean,
you never
how
know.
Cool is that? And you never know. It's a really, really long shot, obviously, but you never can tell. I mean, it could take you a lifetime if you send an email to Robert Klein trying to get him to read a book.
Oh, yeah. It never happened.
He would never get it. He would never have it. So it's serendipity. And so I've done things like that. I also have tried some of these commercial places like BookBub. They advertise where they will get you in front of 60,000. You'll get 60,000 hits. None of that seems to work, literally. Because when I look at Twitter and I see all these book promotions, I'm just one after the other. After a while, right. I just don't pay any attention. I'm thinking,
right.
Well, that's the way other people react to my stuff as well. If you just put out there, although I do use Twitter and I do use Facebook. I think Facebook, up to a certain point, is good. And you're dealing with a lot of people that know you. But then to expand that and get to a larger market, as I'm sure you know, that's a real struggle.
I think it's tough because, you know, you do what you know, and, you know, even though you might have every self-help book out there on how to sell a million books of, you know, Escape from Sugar Island, you know, or Breakout from Sugar Island, you just have, you know, only so many resources with your team of one or two or three that you have available to you. So it's like, what is the secret to getting it in front of the right eyes and then suddenly, you know, you're on the Oprah Winfrey Book Club or something, you know, like that,
right.
You're selling millions of copies. So,
and,
you know, if we
you know, I just
that
one
out.
Quick anecdote. We had a presenter about 2 months ago in SCWA, and this guy had gotten on, I think, the morning show, and he had gotten on Steve Colbert, but his wife was a director for the Orange is the New Black. So he,
yeah.
She obviously, so he had some connections, but he got on these two shows, and then he stopped. He says, "Guess how many books I sold." He held up his one hand, five and two fingers. He sold 7 books.
Right.
So out of all of that, there's no guarantee either.
Yeah.
Even with
yeah.
that kind of high-powered exposure.
Yeah. And,
so it's
and
a struggle.
That is fascinating to me because, you know, you think, well, if I'm on The Tonight Show or I'm on The Colbert Show, boy, those books are just going to fly off the shelves and I'm going to be back in that Brinks truck right up the bank. But that's really not how it works. And I don't know. I always find it interesting to be a creative type in this world on how to market and get your stuff out there. But we've got 2 minutes left here today, Seamus. Any shameless plugs, people you'd like to say hello to, anything like that that you'd like to leave the listeners with today?
Well, you know, I'm thankful for the people that have helped me, from Matt Palomari and you know, being my editor, and he is going great guns. He is, one of his novels, Spirit Matters, now has been translated into Norwegian, and it's been translated into Italian and German. So I'm glad for him that this is taken out. At one time he joked, he said, "I've become an overnight celebrity after 30 years.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I Larry Porcelli has been great. SCWA, Southern California Writers Association, has really been fabulous. I think he's a very positive person that runs that. He really supports writers.
Yeah.
He's interested in them. He gives you exposure, and he's very genuine. He's a fun guy. And no, all the people that have bought my books, obviously I'm very thankful. And my wife has been a mainstay of my writing career. I mean, without her, I don't know what I'd have done, because there's an awful lot of work that goes into this before you get it on the market as a book, obviously, as you
yeah.
know.
And with that, Seamus, guess what? We're now really kind of out of time. Everybody, there's a link for Seamus's Amazon author page right on the show. Just click his name. It's a hyperlink. You can go buy his book, buy 10 copies, one for you, 9 for your friends, gift them out.
and your friends will thank you later on. On behalf of everybody who's listening today, thank you for being here. We'll be back live tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock with Rebecca Fisk. Seamus, thank you again for taking time out of your day. I can't wait to have you back. And everybody else, have a great day. Stay cool wherever you are today.
You've been listening to
Rated G Radio.